Hey everyone, welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. This is part two of my interview with Dan Sullivan, Rose Hall Run winemaker, owner, doing it for ages, making beautiful wines in Prince Edward County. And if you remember, we ended by talking about soil and the differences in the vineyards around Rose Hall Run. Part two, it starts with barrel tasting some of his other Chardonnays, library Chardonnays, like some of his older stuff, which I think is great. Like we tried one of his most famous ones, the 2013 JCR Chardonnay, which was a great wine, despite being a very tough vintage. And it won lots of medals, including a silver at the Decanter World Wine Awards. And I've talked about it before. I love vineyards that keep a library. And I know it's difficult to do. And eventually a wine runs out. Eventually we're done with it. A wine hits its, you know, life expectancy and there's going to be no more of it. That's fine. But you know, you like to be able to try older wines, to be able to just get a sense of the terroir, a sense of the vintage. I think that kind of stuff's important, and just a sense of history. And it's something we don't do a lot of in the New World. I mean, by the way, there's a lot of places in Italy where they complain about not having enough of their wine. And I get why they sell it. One, it's a product. You got to make money. And that's how they make money, is by selling their wine. So by keeping it longer and longer, that's just assets that are just sitting there. And that's money that you might need for mortgage, for equipment, for training, for, you know, just all the day in and day out expenses of making wine. And there's issues of storage and things like that. So I understand it, but I always love any vineyard that has old wines to sample, to try, to buy, and all that kind of stuff. So in the second part, barrel tasting, more Chardonnay, an interesting sort of analogy of how being a winemaker is like being Ted Williams. We talk a lot about Prince Edward County versus Burgundy, and there are similarities and obviously major, major differences. And the biggest one that we'll discuss is just time, is that, you know, think about it. Burgundy has had hundreds of years of a head start, so they know, they can microanalyze almost every plot of land and have a pretty good idea of the potential for making great wine there. That is something that's going to take time here in Canada, just like it is in a lot of winemaking areas of the world. What the future is for Prince Edward County, for their vineyard, and also trying a Tempranillo. That's something you don't normally do when you're in Prince Edward County. So here is part two of my interview with winemaker Dan Sullivan.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
I wanted to talk to you about Tempranillo and about your small lots wines, your Pinot, your Merlot, your Cab Franc. Was there another Chardonnay, because we did the 19, we did the 18, was there another one you wanted to taste through before I get into some of the questions?
So we actually have two more Chardonnays that I want to taste.
Oh, perfect.
And so we'll kind of finish our thought on the journey of, in this case, the grape Chardonnay at Rose Hall Run. So we're going to go into the library, which is right over here.
Well, that reminds me, I want to talk to you about your library as well, which is rare, because so many New World wineries, they don't keep some of their old wines. I remember Southbrook. This was years ago. It was one of the first times I sort of noticed this. I'm like, oh, good for you. I can buy, you know, a Chardonnay that's 7-8 years old, which, you know, if you're in Montrachet, that's no big deal. But in North America, it's much more rare.
Yeah, and I think that there isn't really an element of collectability to North American stuff yet. Mm-hmm. And Bill Riddlemeyer, the proprietor of Southbrook, is one of my favorite people in the industry.
He's great.
Just a super thoughtful guy.
Yeah.
Always has something interesting to say. And I think in many ways is a real visionary. And so I have a huge amount of admiration for what Bill is and does.
Yeah.
But at this, you know, I just wanted to create a bit of an archive. As I said, I started as a wine lover, and I actually wish that we did a bit better job of collecting and holding on to our wines better. But, you know, there's a lot of demand for it, and there are some commercial pressures, and these wines, I do think
You got that, a mortgage, you got rent.
Well,
you got
well
costs.
That and the other thing too is that there is a window of drinkability for, yeah. for all products. And you know, I don't want to hold them down here just for the sake of saying that I have them.
There is an ego of, yeah, I have a 17-year-old bottle of my JCR. It's like, that's great, but there's a chance it might have started to turn.
Yeah, however, you know, sometimes it's going back to the film analogy. You can learn as much about a bad film by a great director as you can
right.
from a good film by somebody that you know is you know more of a kind of journeyman mm-hmm. Type of producer of anything. So in that sense, I'm not afraid to hold a couple of bottles back, but to go and hold 20 cases or something of that kind of doesn't make sense. And, you know, you have a limited amount of space. But what we are going to do is we're going to go into the recent past and taste the back vintage. So I think we'll probably taste the 16, and then which was a hot year. And then we'll go and taste the 13, which is the vintage that you alluded to.
Oh, that'd be fantastic.
That you wanted to ask.
Yeah,
so we have some of
curious.
That here. So,
oh, that's
so let's
right.
let's
yeah.
go and do that. And yeah. then you can we'll pull a couple of we've got some extra glasses here, so we'll pull them and we'll do them side by side.
Perfect.
And then you can kind of give a running commentary on yeah. on your thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're back, and this is the JCR 2016 Chardonnay. Yeah, again, it is so funny to, you know, when you have the recent, just in your mind, the 2019 versus, you know, the 16, which is in bottle. I was going to ask before, talk about it, what is the amount, like, when you, how many years between when you plant the vine to when you release? Like, how long does it spend in barrel and bottle
right.
before it's released to the public?
So so the planting of the vines is one thing. So you're essentially 4 years in. You might get a very small crop in the third leaf of a vine, but you're 4 years in. So, for example, our first really significant crush here at Rosehall Run, we made a little bit of 2004, but 2005 and 6 were the 2 years where we really started taking off. But the journey of this wine, the 16, for example, so this was harvested in, it was harvested a bit earlier than normal because 16 was a hot year, but essentially late September, early October. Mm-hmm. And then it spent until the spring, early spring or late winter of 2018 before it came out of wood. And then it was bottled in March or April of 2018, so about 16 to 18 months
yep.
after harvest. And then I forget exactly when this was released, to be honest. You'd have to check with our tasting room people, but I imagine this probably came out in the fall of 18. So the wine was almost 2 years old when it was released. And that is pretty much follows the trajectory yep. of both the Pinot and the Chardonnay. In that, usually there between 2 years and between 24 and 30 months on release, and they'll vary a little bit from vintage to vintage.
There's a little like just there's a little salty. There's a little like white salt.
Like a little saline kind of character
to it. Yeah, going on here.
Dare I say minerality,
yeah,
Matthew?
I listen, I believe in it. I believe in it. Just there's always that push and pull with some of the skeptics out there. But no, there is. The saline character, the saline character is absolutely here.
And
which is remarkable because you said 16 is a hot year.
Yes.
So then the stereotype is hot year, big, more fruit.
That's where winemaking comes into it, and so you learn a lot from the years that have come before. So we have experienced hot years in Prince Edward County, obviously, and so 2016, 2012, before that 2010 and 2007, and so what you learn is that as opposed to tinkering with the wine very much, what you can do is you can tinker a little bit with your pick dates.
Right.
And so what I did was I actually picked about a third of this a little bit earlier, about a week after we picked for a little bit of the sparkling wine that we did, which is usually it's about 2 weeks. And so we picked a portion of our vineyard.
Right.
And the sugar was good on it, mm-hmm. But I was picking more for the acidity and the flavor of it. And then I left the rest of it to hang for a relatively normal amount of time. And then I actually fermented them separately and then picked the barrels for the cuvée. And mm-hmm. I actually declassified two of the barrels on this and put it into another blend. And then this was the resulting wine.
By the way, winemakers remind me of a good baseball hitter. And I'll explain. You can, like, I remember my dad, who was friends with Jackie Robinson, and he knew the last guy to hit over 400 for the Red Sox. I can't believe I'm
Ted Williams.
Ted Williams. Wow, thank you. I'm the one who works in sports. And like these savant hitters can tell you almost every home run they hit and what count it was. And, well, it was a curveball, then a fastball. And it's the same thing for you. 2016, hot vintage, a third we picked off before. It was a week after our sparkling. And then, all those things.
It's funny because you remember the events around it, right?
Right.
And so maybe Ted Williams was remembering they were in a pennant race and they were playing against, the Yankees. And, they knew that there was a tough pitcher on the mound and so there's all that background information that they're building off of that creates the mental map of where they've been. And I think it's the same thing in wine where, I've been so intricately and intimately involved with this operation from the outset that it's not like the fruit is coming in from some place that I don't know about and I'm interpreting it when it hits the crush pad. It's that I've been kind of growing with this all along. And so that, I think, is the inherent benefit of estate-produced stuff if you're a vigneron in the sense that you're all growing it and making it. And I think it's one of the few small advantages that small producers and small growers have when they want to really hone into it and pay attention to it. And that's not that big houses can't do that as well. But I'm wondering if they're, in the translation between a vineyard manager and, a winemaker that's doing certain things.
Yeah.
It's largely dependent on how intimately involved they are with that aspect of it. And if you've got a winemaker that's making 70 different lots of wine, and this is one of the things, they're probably perhaps not spending as much time.
Well, they can't. They're a human being.
Exactly.
At some point, you have to sleep.
So in that sense, I think that's the defense of small, is that it allows you that ability to be the connectedness.
Yeah.
And for me, when you talk about sustainability and all the other things, I think the underlying thing that makes great wines is that there's a connectedness to what's going on in the vineyard. You're actually looking at it and you're paying attention and how your vines and your vineyard are behaving. And sometimes it's on a very kind of just a visceral level. Like you just get a feeling like I better go out and look at that. Mm-hmm. And there's some mornings where I'll just come up and I go, you know what? I got to go and look at that. And you don't even know why you're doing it, but you are. And quite often, it's that sixth sense or intuition about something and it's right.
And I agree with you on the small vineyard because you do get to have more control. And the thing is, you could have a lot of really talented people on the larger sites, but then it still is about everyone communicating, everyone being on the same board.
Right.
And when there's more communication lines, that's when there usually leads to, at some point, some miscommunication.
Oh, there can be for sure, but
not even a huge one. Just a little dint here or there.
But I also know, some of the winemakers that I know from bigger properties, that's where they tend to focus a lot of their attention is on a very kind of high level of things. But then they'll have very skilled winemakers that are in charge of particular programs or lots of wine in the operation, and they do baby them, So that's not to say that large houses aren't capable of it. But I think that there's, it's maybe a bit romantic, but that connection between being a small producer and really knowing your farm is huge to me. And I'm not sure that there's anything that can really replace it.
The saline is there on the palate. I get like... you know, there is a little bit of that butter. There is a little bit of that Chardonnay that I want.
It's a little bigger.
Yeah, it is a little bigger. I get a little sweet. This is going to be a real douchey term, but like a sweet, slightly cooked orange peel. There is a sweetness thing going on. There's a little bit of...
So that's the caramelization.
Yeah, thank you. Like I was going to go burnt, a little bit of burnt brown sugar.
So I think there's two things there. Number one is the flavor development of the way that the wood is impacting it. And also just age itself. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of softens everything. It kind of rounds it out. And there's a very, very slight amount of oxidation mm-hmm. that's taken place there, but not in a way that it tastes like tired.
No. Like I like oxidation. You know, like this in my Chardonnay. It's one of the first wineries that really turned me on to.
Actually, I would say that this is a very unoxidized Chardonnay for the age that it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, keeping in mind that you know this is now over 4 years old, and from a hot vintage, mm-hmm. And so you know, I easily see this wine going at least another 4 to 5 years.
Oh, absolutely.
Comfortably,
yeah.
Without tiring out. And what I don't ever think will happen with this wine is I don't think that it will turn into like sherry.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go. So next up is the 13. So keep in mind, this is a wine that is now 7 years old.
Right. By the way, before I smell and taste, and this is a question I like to ask to almost every winemaker. What are the biggest I mean, probably you're more calm now, probably more stoic now than when you started, but what are some of the differences between you, Dan, as a winemaker in 2020 versus, say, 2009?
Well, I think that there's a lot less anxiety about, carving our place out in the wine world. Honestly, and that's as a proprietor of a winery as well. I'm a lot more comfortable just in letting the wines kind of be what they are. Mm-hmm. And instead of really having the temptation to dial something in to try and perfect it.
Was that something that, not that you did it all the time, but you were, I imagine, more tempted when you were younger just to try to, because have a sense of control, because that's got to be like, if you are a total control freak, it's interesting in this business, you've got to be able to micromanage, but at the same point, you have to be able to just go down that river because you can't really control.
So I used to get really bent out of shape at what Pinot Noirs would taste like at this time of year, the following year. And you just learn over time that they just tend to be really awkward. Actually, the 19s are very unusual in the fact that they actually taste pretty fully formed right now, whereas in most years they don't. And so that anxiousness about where the wines were going to go is something over time that you get used to. But you just make sure that there's nothing going off the rails, as we said before. So it's really a sense of patience with it. And then you just have more experiences to draw upon with the vineyard. But I think that, honestly, some of the things that are maybe a bit easier is just that, you know, we're not under such as bad financial strain as what we were early on.
Yeah.
And I think that that allows you more leeway to take sometimes a little bit more risk or to do things that you wouldn't be permitted to do otherwise.
Because you have security. And with some sense of financial security, yeah, it does allow you to reach a
Not
little
that
bit.
We're getting rich anytime
no, oh, no,
quick,
no, no, no,
you
no,
know,
no
but,
one, no one ever
this
gets.
This is a very, very tough business.
And, oh, yeah. The margins are crazy. The hours are stressful. I say it, you know, every winemaker says the same thing. You don't go in this business to get rich. I remember I was doing an interview with Thomas Batchelder, and we're in this giant warehouse, and there's Anne Sperling, who you know makes wine all over the world.
Sure.
And you know what she was doing? She was sweeping. It was a Sunday night, and she was sweeping. And I've talked about this on an earlier pod. I'm like, that right there, for people that want to get into it for all the romanticism, and there is some. You're out in the fields. That's a beautiful, wonderful thing. There's also the stress. You ain't getting rich. And some points... Yeah. You're sweeping it. You're sweeping between barrels.
Yeah, it's 90% dishwashing and auto mechanics and 10% Van Gogh. Yeah. You know,
I remember that.
And yeah, there's just a lot of you know, just pragmatic drudgery that goes into making a wine like this.
So the wine we got, 2013 JCR Chardonnay. It won a lot of awards, silver medal, the Decanter Awards, which. Cheers to that, because Decanter, much more European-focused, much more France-focused. Here, my first very fancy thing to say about the nose on this wine, it makes me smile. Like, I dig my nose here, and I just have a big smile. There is an elegance to this wine. So, like, that's like the first thing that just right. pops out. It's aged incredibly well. There's nothing about this that says, "Oh, this is not like Mission Impossible. The clock isn't ticking. You've got 60 seconds or it'll erupt."
No, this has a huge future still in front of it. And so when people are telling you that, and it's all the complexity on the back.
Yeah.
So you get all that kind of the little buttery notes, the little smoky notes, the little...
Mm-hmm.
Kind a little, little funky nutty things.
Yeah, like a little bit like if you took a little bit of honey and wrapped it in a cooked almond.
And you know, if you were living in 2013 in Ontario, you would have never guessed that such difficult conditions throughout a growing season would result in a wine of, you know, such sort of temporal memory. Of what the year was like, right? And just
yeah, a vibrant orange, yeah. A vibrant stone fruit,
so alive, you know.
Oh God,
and,
yeah.
And you know, I wish I could take credit for making that, but I can't. It grows, mm-hmm. and so all that I'm doing is just interpreting what's going on. I think in the right way. And to me anyway, you know, maybe for somebody else, it's not the right way for them, but for me, it's the right way for me.
You're never going to get 100% approval rating. It's right. It's not going to happen. You know, it's the same thing with you know, a sports talk radio host. Some people are going to call in or write in and say, yeah, those are great take. Other people are going to say, you don't know what you're talking about.
Sure.
You know, get off the air.
Yep. And I have you know, friends that have been collecting and customers that have been collecting wines, and they'll sort of have their own sort of insider's dope on you know, what was the best season you ever had kind of sort of talk. And there's most people actually prefer the 14 to the 13. I'm a bigger fan of the 13 than I am the 14, but I'm a bit of an outlier in that, because the 14 has a little bit heavier on the palate, and people like that extra breadth on this. For me, I really, really like the just how crisp and the line on this wine is, but it's not as plush certainly as the 14 or even the 16 that you had before it. And so when we take this wine and then we circle back to the 19.
Oh my God.
But you can taste structurally in the acid there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a similarity.
A little bit of fennel. Yeah. And you'll still hear it, like when I hang out, and this is mostly men, when they say, I'm not going to drink Ontario Red. And there's that's out there. It's less now than when you got started, thankfully.
Right.
What about when people try to say, you know, to compare Prince Edward with Burgundy? And I fully think you can. I think you could take this wine and you could put it up against, you know, a lot of, you know, premier cru level wines, and it will be able to compete. I'm curious your thoughts just about, I don't even know if that's an ambition of yours or just your thoughts on the idea of, you know, the perception of Burgundy versus the perception of Prince Edward County.
Well, you know, Burgundy's had a 500 or 600 or 700 year head start.
Like a bit of a head start.
But having said that, you know, the county is the county, and Ontario is Ontario. But I don't think that it's a coincidence that there are some structural elements that are shared with a lot of European wine regions. And I think, again, it goes back to cool climate, exactly, and soil types and limestone. But the other part of the terroir is the people that are making it. And what's interesting is that in Europe, it's been around so long that winemakers have come and gone and come and gone and come and gone. And what's transcended is the place. Whereas here in Prince Edward County, we're so new and so young that I don't think that we fully mapped, obviously, not fully mapped out what we are as a region.
All the different, the different appellations.
We're essentially still in the first generation of winemakers here. And so it tends to be a little bit more focused on the people. Mm-hmm. But I think over time, if this region is ultimately a success, it will be based on the place that it is. And I think that that's a credit to everybody here in Prince Edward County, that there's a pride in being from this place. And I think it's born out of a fact that it's so difficult to do here. And we all
bonds you guys together.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Certainly with the shared hardship of getting a wine from the field into the bottle and how painstaking an operation it is just to sustain it every single year. And, you know, I'll let time and other people determine, you know, map that terroir. What I'm more interested in and what I have control over is mapping what goes on here.
Right.
And in other you know, places where I'm lucky enough to get fruit from, and so for me the map is just vintage to vintage, time to time, block to block on where we are, and so far I think it's working out.
I don't disagree. Because we don't have much time left,
sure.
And I've kept you for well over an hour. And then, by the way, for people listening, this is the part two of this interview with Dan Sullivan. I'm going to be breaking it up into two parts. Tempranillo.
Yeah.
Does it work here? The motivation behind it. You know, when I think Tempranillo outside of, you know, Spain or in cool climate, part of me goes, You're just trying to make life more difficult for yourself. But I'm curious about that.
Well, you know, I mean, it's always good to push the boundaries a little
bit.
So I joke, I never bet the whole farm on it. I only bet about 4% of it. So we have a little over 25 acres planted of vines here. And we have a little under one acre of Tempranillo, actually.
Yeah.
And
you're not ripping up all your Pinot and planting Tempranillo.
And so what the Tempranillo that we have planted here. So I did a little bit of researching and it started from the fact that I wanted an alternative red to Pinot Noir that we were growing. And I certainly thought that Cab Franc, and I'll level with you, I thought Cab Franc had no chance here in Prince Edward County when I first got here. I never planted any.
Yeah.
But I was fortunate enough. I've actually worked with more Cab Franc probably in the county than anybody. I've actually worked with four different sites.
Really?
Of Cab Franc here. And it responds really, really well to good viticulture. And so if you're willing to cut a little bit of crop, expose the fruit, things that you know, over the last 10 to 15 to 20 years, we've really learned about it. I really think it's terrific. But I decided to go in a little different direction. So I started doing some reading about varietals. And there were some interesting things that I was looking at, but there was no vine stock that was available for it, like Mondieus and some Savoie grapes. And they were a little too esoteric. But I loved Tempranillo. I loved the best, what I thought were really good Spanish Tempranillos. And so I started doing some reading. And it actually ripens 3 days ahead of Cabernet Franc in nurseries in France where they grow it. So I felt that the ripening cycle certainly was something that was achievable here in Prince Edward County. But of course the whole winter aspect of things was a game changer. But we bury the vines here, so I wasn't all that concerned about that. So I had a variety called Ehrenfelser that I ripped out 1 acre of. I replanted it to the Tempranillo, and we produced our first wine from it in 17. I'll grab a bottle of it, and we can try it. And so in no way, shape, or form will it remind you of a Spanish Tempranillo. But I was also looking at the trends in not just Tempranillo growing, but in grape growing in general, in places where historically they were grown in hot places like California, like Spain, like the south of France, and how They were kind of following a lot of the great places that came before them and planting them in sort of, for lack of a better term, riskier sites where it was colder, where it was a little bit cooler, because what they were doing is they were trying to chase some of that elegance and delicacy and finesse that you're not going to get baking on the bottom of the valley floor. And if you go into Spain, into some of the areas, most of the great wines that are emerging are from hillside sites in cooler, and they're moving further north and further west. So for me, intuition and just, you know, basically looking at that sort of led me to think, well, you know what, why not try and do it? And it's a great talking point, and but at the end of the day, you know, hopefully the wine is good. And I fully realize we're not going to get there every year with that as a red wine, but you know, it's like going back to the baseball analogy, if you hit 400, you're doing pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And so
also,
you know,
means the other, there's still six other times you're not getting a hit.
Exactly. Yeah. So so I, as I said, we can afford to hedge a little bit of that risk for 1 acre of it and make something that's, you know, makes a statement and is a little bit noteworthy and kind of pushes the boundaries a little bit. So I'm happy to do that.
All right. We got to end this in a sec. Wait, where are you going, Dan? Where are you going?
I was
going
to go and get you some Tempranillo, but we can do camera.
No. If you want to grab it, we can try a little on. Yeah. Sure. Pardon me, this is doing it because I feel bad for you. I'm taking up so much of your time.
Well, I know you have another appointment, so we'll wrap it up. But yeah, not before. So there's an old saying, a wine's first duty is to be red. So we'll finish off with a red one.
Perfect. Yeah, we'll try a little red, then we'll end off there. So we got the 2017 Tempranillo, And yeah, as you were saying, it's not going to remind you of one from Rioja. And my thing is, I don't want it to. It's supposed to express where it's grown. And also, if our wines taste like Rioja, then we're in a lot of trouble. I mean, you know, we already have issues with climate change. We're in a lot worse place if suddenly everything tastes like Rioja here.
Sure. And you know, it's interesting that, you know, in a lot of places in the world where they're starting to rethink some of the varietals that they do have planted, and they're permitting new ones. In Bordeaux, they've just approved six new varieties, for making generic Bordeaux. And so, you know, it, maybe it portends to what the future is going to hold.
There's still the nice red fruit, the nice ripe red. There's some pepper on this, mm-hmm. Like if I was blinding this, my first thought, like just, and again, you know, I would be trying to game the system, which is the number one no-no. My nose is starting to go towards cool climate Syrah.
Right.
That's where my nose is starting at. But there's a little bit more jammy. A little bit more, you know, when the people say strawberry jam. Or
that's actually a great analogy for me, I would say.
Yeah, it's like slightly dark strawberry jam. Yeah, strawberry jam, a little bit of pepper, a little blue fruit.
Yep, but a really nice, elegant.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, it's not as beefy as, and tannic is a lot, but there's a fair bit of density there.
Yeah, you know what I would say? I like to sometimes, you know, if you drink this and you want it, you know, you should try this.
Right.
If you're an Ontario Gamay fan, you want to see something a little bit different, but where it's not like 180 degree difference, you know, I would say try this. You know, there's this is lovely. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So as we end this, you know, you've been doing this for over 30 years. What, you know?
Well, 25.
25. All right, we'll round down. Well, I think on your bio it says 30 years of, it says 30 years of winemaking, I think is what it says on the website, but 25 years here.
Yeah. Anyway.
So 25 years here at Rose Hill Run. Goals, thoughts, aspirations, and it doesn't have to be giant things, about where you'd like to be in the next 5 to 10 years.
So I think, you know, as I'm getting a little bit older, the whole piece of of sustainability in the standpoint where not just us, but where as a region and as an industry, is Ontario going? And so it's not just succession planning with us per se, but what does the future hold For our industry, and there are incredible pressures economically on what we're doing as an industry, and I spend a fair amount of time being engaged in making sure that our industry is something that's going to remain viable in the future, and we're at a real crossroads in that. We're making better wine now than we've ever made. We're in the golden age of Canadian and Ontario wines. And I think that we're kind of at a point where we're waiting for the world and the rest of even Ontario to kind of catch up with that. There's a lot of people like you that already do get it, but there's a lot more people that, you know, when they come in and they taste an experience like this, some of the great wines of the world are being made here in Ontario now.
Oh, yeah. And the Ontario government doesn't give the same level of support as the BC government does to them.
Absolutely
and,
not.
I mean, that's, you know, a topic for another day. But
Having been in the industry now for 15 years, I'm more hopeful now that we're going to get positive change and reform in the tax structure so that we're not treated like imported product in our own market.
It's ridiculous.
And if we can get to that point, then it becomes a model where it's not that, you know, every small producer is fighting a tooth and nail just to try and keep their door open and, you know, give them, you know, remain sustainable and open, because part of the sustainability model is it has to be something there that somebody is going to want to take over without having to sacrifice everything to do it. And and for heaven's sakes, you know, if you're in business, you know, it's not supposed to be a struggle every single year to stay in business.
Yeah.
And that's how other wine regions have evolved and grown and become champions in the wine world is that they've been able to reinvest back into their businesses to grow them and to create something that's more sustainable. And so for me, that's the next part of it. So a lot of our focus will be on sustainability within the winery itself, using minimal inputs, reclaiming water, our viticulture practices, and also with our people, that there's a path forward for people to grow and to create a meaningful difference, not just at Rose Hall Run, but in the community at large.
Yeah, and my final thought here, then I want you to promote Rose Hall Run, where people can find you, is for me, for this podcast, there's two reasons why I push Ontario wine. It's not really about nationalism or a chip on the shoulder. Oh, why don't you like
the
us?
The wines are damn good, Matt.
But I was getting there. Is that there's two things. One is I like this podcast to open people's eyes to different regions, and especially with people tending to want more elegance and less alcohol, go to a cool climate area like Ontario. But the main reason I push Ontario wines is it's really fucking good.
Right.
You know, it's just, do you want Riesling? Great. Here, here, or here. Do you want Chardonnay? Here's all the areas.
Right.
Do you want Pinot or Gamay?
I can tell you, coming off of 3 weeks in California, where it was all about the Pinot when I was out there tasting it, a bunch of iconic houses that are just getting to where we are as far as viticulture is now, believe it or not.
Yeah.
You know, we were the leaders, not the followers, and where we went out into cool climate, and we went out on the edge and we went out and took risks, and they're doing it their own way, but following in our footsteps and discovered what we discovered 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And when I take a look at the price points of those products compared to what we're charging, even aside from the exchange rate, our wines are bargains.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so, you know, if nothing else, you know, people tend to be drinking a little bit less, but drinking a little bit better. And, you know, you open up a bottle of a good Ontario Pinot Noir, it's going to deliver pretty much every time.
Yeah. And if the only knock you can say is Ontario is not going to consistently make a big Cabernet Sauvignon,
well, guess what?
You've got the rest of planet Earth to get that from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I guess overall, on a big picture, is we're figuring out what we do best and we're comfortable in our own skins doing it.
Incredibly well said. Thank you again. Like, just first, that was a cool just going through, you know, from the 19 to the 18 to the 16 to that brilliant 13 of the JCR Chardonnay. Where do people go? Where do websites? Where do they need? I mean, you guys are, you know, if you're going to the pizza oven Norm Hardy, you guys are 18 feet away from there. But how do people come here?
So people come here, they can hop in their car and come and visit Prince Edward County. It's not just about the wine in the summer. It's about the beach. It's about the incredible restaurant and artisan scene that we have here. All the other wineries that I share the county with, you know, no man is an island, and I would encourage you to taste at as many different places as you can, responsibly.
Yep.
And then I think that... you know, the other piece for Rose Hall Run is we will deliver free to your home.
So
you can go to our online store and join our wine club if that's the way that you roll, and on any order of 6 bottles or more, we'll deliver free to your home. And then we have 3 wines that are available in the LCBO in the general list program, and many of our wines are available for tasting here at the winery, but they're never more than a couple of days away if you want to go online and order them.
That's perfect. It's the county is gorgeous. You're right by the water. It's a really nice tasting room here at Rose Hall Run. Fully recommend the Pinot. I mean, we didn't even get time to get everything, but obviously the Pinot and the Chard is what they're known for. But then try, you know, when you're here, try some Pixie, try some Defiant.
Sparkling wine is sort of one of our newer endeavors, but we've kind of dove into that full on, and we've got a really nice estate grown Blanc de Blanc called Ceremony, and then a vintage dated one that we're only doing in special vintages called Stardust that is Charlie's favorite.
Right, yeah, Charlie? Well, Charlie right now is using my jacket as a blanket, so I think we'll end it there. Dan Sullivan, Rose Hall Run, really appreciate you taking time out of your day. Really appreciate
Thanks,
you doing
Matthew.
The podcast. Thank
great,
you.
Great. Thanks for stopping by.
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, download, rate, subscribe, tell your friends. You can get me on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.